What is the second human evolution? The second human evolution has to be planned. It is no longer the time of the first world, the first human evolution. That's over. We have to be God. We have to be humans who could learn from our mistakes, learn from the past, learn from our history, learn from each other, and start talking and discussing what that second human evolution must be in order for us to stave off whatever this sixth extinction is that I hear about.
Welcome to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for people like you who care about the social impact of conscious companies and everyday heroes. Hear inspiring stories from those who put people and planet before profit and personal gain. You'll learn how you can make a difference, vote with your dollars, and get involved today. Here's your host, Karina Balizzi.
Hello, fellow do-gooders and friends. I'm your host, Karina Balizzi. This show is an invitation of sorts. Each week, I invite you to care more about a particular issue so that we can learn together and then really build a path towards creating a better world. I'm coming off of the heels of my personal experience at Natural Products Expo West, the industry that I work within and call my home. And it really has me thinking about so many different things, but namely, one really alarming trend that has continued over the last decade and doesn't seem to be slowing down. There is a massive consolidation going on in today's entrepreneurial climate. It's becoming increasingly hard for small businesses to grow and thrive. It's really doing one thing very well, which is consolidating wealth in the pockets of the few and creating less versatility, less selection, less real uniqueness in the marketplace as a whole. And that same alarming trend also exists in the world of healthcare. Local, independent family care practitioners used to be more the norm. You could find people who served their local community and were truly connected to it. But today, those are becoming something of the past. Larger conglomerates are moving in. In my local area, they've been swallowed up by PAMF, short for the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. And I have to say, that name is deceptive. You hear the word foundation and you assume, oh, well, this would be another do-gooder of sorts. They would put family first and service first. But that actually hasn't proven to be the case. I have found the opposite to be true. Right now, this is a trend across coast to coast of the United States and is becoming more global. It's part of, I think, globalization in addition, but also consolidation of wealth, power, and money. So I know this may be a little bit of a stretch off topic as I introduce today's guest, but he's also really intrinsically connected to the medical care system, and I'd like to inquire about his perspective. So today, I'm going to introduce you to a pioneer and a veteran of that healthcare system who's dedicated his career to building a system that truly supports humanity across the globe. He has dedicated more than 50 years to this work. He's the president and founder of Care for Peace, a 501c3 foundation that has its home based in Northern California. Jeffrey began his career as a hospital corpsman in the United States Coast Guard and has been developing hospital services and facilities ever since. Prior to selling his healthcare consultation company to a Fortune 500 firm in 1998, Jeffrey facilitated innovative and widely publicized management operations and new facility development services for over 120 hospitals across the U.S. and also facilitating and managing international sister hospital relationships overseas. He joins me today to talk about this experience and his book, To Care for Peace, which is a global mandate to secure the second human evolution in perpetuity. I'd like you to welcome Jeffrey along with me to the show. Thank you so much for joining me, Jeffrey Charles Hardy.
Thank you for joining me, Karina Balizzi. I hope I said your name correctly.
Balizzi, but I do enjoy a Bellini now and then.
I like Balizzi. No, that's good. I will remember that.
Now, I thought I would start by hearing your perspective about the state of our current healthcare system in America. How has it changed over the years that you've been in this business? And why, frankly, is it getting somewhat worse?
A heavy, loaded question. So I'm going to have to give you a heavy and loaded answer.
Right. I'd expect nothing less.
Before 1982, it was cost reimbursement. So hospitals were reimbursed for their costs. In 1982, all of a sudden, this system came about where it was called DRGs, diagnostic related groups. And all of a sudden, it was these payment chunks for whatever the disease was that a patient was in the hospital for, which meant that the coders who were sitting there trying to interpret what was going on in the hospital and putting it into a number were in charge of the number that got interpreted for patient payment. And so it was a mess. And what happened was corporate medicine came about at that point, and it's been a mess ever since. So a lot of things happened during that time. I was a protege of the gentleman who started Kaiser Foundation Hospitals and Clinics, one of the biggest health management organizations in the world. Dr. Sidney Garfield and Drs. Maury Collin came up with this health maintenance organization idea, which worked really well when they were really focusing maintaining patients' health. They had multi-phasic health systems connected to this so that every patient would go and have lots and lots of tests and radiology, laboratory, you name it. So the multi-phasic testing process identified this patient and we could take care of this patient for the rest of his life. Well, the only problem is that costs a lot of money. So they don't do that anymore. And I think one of the biggest problems we have right now is that it's not a health maintenance organization. It's the corporate health organization maintenance organization. And so you have to do a lot of your care searches and your care assessments by yourself, which was difficult at first, but I'm getting used to it. I kind of like the fact that I can Google whatever it is that I think I have, even before the doctor says, yeah, that's what you have.
Dr. Google is replacing your care.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm right most of the time.
I mean, that's sad. Isn't that sad?
Yes, it is.
So I want to share a moment of my personal experience because I think the audience will relate. For years, I really focused on making sure that my health insurance allowed a PPO because I wanted to choose a local care provider that enabled me to not have to go to an HMO first and get a referral, right? I wanted to be able to target the family doctor and go to a different OBGYN if I wanted to. And if I had an issue with my foot, I could go to a podiatrist without having to get a referral to referral to referral, right? And I really liked that because it meant that I could work with specialists in their field that I heard from my community were very good at what they did. But that changed when my local favorite office was swallowed by PAMF. And PAMF, the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, came in and they instituted their policies and their changes. And this really culminated in experience for me when my son had an ear infection. This is common when kids are little, right? So I take him to the office to have them look at his ear. This wasn't his first ear infection, but he was really troubled by it. I mean, I had an otoscope at home because I was that mom trying to figure out what's going on with my kid. Is it inflamed enough to visit the doctor? Whatever. So he had some wax that was blocking his eardrum, making the infection kind of worse, right? And this doctor, I usually would see a physician's assistant, a PA, but today I got in directly with a doctor. She just picked up a metal tool, scooped inside his ear, and put it down. And so she touched the implant for maybe 5 seconds, really, right? This was considered an additional procedure in coding within PAMF. And so I now had to pay something like $160 out of pocket in addition to my copay for coming into the office. Now, I also found out on the heels of this that my physician's assistant said, yeah, you know, I just wouldn't have coded for it because I know that's what they do, but we're getting pressure from the management company to do so, which really told me that this is all about profit and not about service to the patient. It's an impersonalization of the entire experience and creates profit centers that are completely without service to the patient. So my first question to them when I encountered this was, how is this do no harm? Like, you're doing harm to me. You didn't ask me if this was something that I would approve if I knew it was going to cost me an extra $160 that I would not be able to have assessed in a health claim. And this is also moving us in a direction of unaffordable healthcare. It's not just the level of service, it's how these things are coded and how we serve the populace. And I feel like it's broken. So since I've gone to HMO, I'm at Kaiser now. I think they serve me better, frankly. I don't get these sunk weird costs coming out of nowhere, but I also have to get a referral for just about anything. So it's not as easy to manage my family's health in this system, but it certainly costs me less. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think I speak for most Americans when I just say I'm frustrated. Like, this is not good.
I am too. And I respect your situation. I think you did the right thing too. I'm a Kaiser protege. And because of that, I've been a Kaiser member for eons. And so I'm its worst critic. At one time, they actually listened to me because they knew who my bosses were. But right now, as a Kaiser patient, yes, I have to go to referrals. If I want dermatology, I've got to go to a doctor and have the doctor take a photograph of the dermatology problem I think I have. And then they send the photograph to the dermatologist who decides whether he's going to see me or not.
Yeah, I've had that experience too.
But I'm used to that. It's okay. I'm just saying, okay, that's fine.
And they're pretty quick. I mean, it's not a completely broken system. It certainly isn't me getting charged $160 for someone to touch an implement. So from that perspective, it's better. But I also just feel like it's the same thing I opened the show with, which is just that there's this incredible consolidation that is happening, which really does concentrate wealth and provides less options for people. So I don't know if that's what's right. And I'm frustrated. I think there's not a solution in this comment. It's just, I feel like if we talk about it more, then perhaps we can also initiate some change. And even the templates in your book might help us get there too. So I'd like to talk about your work, To Care for Peace. I already started this show covering the reason I started it. It's an invitation to care more so we can create this better world. And I really feel like this is something you're working to do with this book. So what does this work, To Care for Peace, mean to you?
Well, first of all, we have a commonality in the fact that our names, Care for Peace and Care More, Be Better, is just as synonymous. They work together. So my book, which is To Care for Peace, A Global Mandate to Secure the Second Human Evolution in Perpetuity. It is very important to understand that care for peace is what you really have to get into this discussion with the rest of the world if we are going to get from the first human evolution, which is dead, it's gone, it's over, to a second human evolution, which we have not planned yet. Caveat emptor, buyer beware. I am a 50-year veteran healthcare system planner, so I can't get the planning mode out of my brain. It's just in there. So when I go to another country, I follow exactly the same formula as I did when I was in America, helping owners and architects and nurses and doctors design $500 million hospitals. And I start with a whole pre-planning process. But the thing that is so important to me is that we come to the discussion caring for peace. Now, what does that mean? Care is an active process that when I was a hospital corpsman in the Coast Guard long, long time ago, when the Vietnam War was going and I was taking care of soldiers coming back from the Mekong Delta, I felt that wonderful feeling when I cared for someone and I called it peace. It wasn't happiness, it was peace. And then when I was later working in hospitals and clinics, I met all these nurses. And guess what? They already know how to care for peace. It's amazing. It's like, wow, this is not something that I felt. It's something that the nurses feel, and they love their jobs. Most of them love their jobs, even when they complain about the number of people that they have to take care of and some of the things that the corporate America has done to nurses to just constrict their jobs. They still care. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, they got into nursing for a reason, and that's evident.
Exactly.
I once interviewed a COVID nurse who's also a dear friend. Like, she had volunteered to be one of the people serving those that had COVID because of her experience as a burn unit nurse. And so they're very accustomed to being in the head-to-toe gear to eliminate the possibility of spreading infection in individuals who are very much compromised with first-degree burns and sometimes covering 80% or more of their bodies. So she's like, I know this game, and this can be something that's very claustrophobic for nurses if they've never experienced having to put on all the PPE. So she talked about that whole experience as being relatively traumatizing, and a lot of nurses ejected from the field during that time because of how emotionally taxing it was. But it was never because they didn't want to continue the work. It was just that things got so bad for so long without relief that they were compromised emotionally.
Yeah. One of the things that I don't know if you remember, but there was this whole movement in healthcare, which everything had to be patient-focused. And I did conferences and seminars where I said, no, I'm interested in nursing focus. And I'll tell you why. Because I'd go to a hospital, and by the end of a shift, nurses were complaining about their knees because they were walking down these long corridors to take care of their patients. And I said, this is not the way to design a nursing unit. No, it's not a patient care unit. It is a nursing unit because they're the ones who are in charge of everything. They are in charge of all the patients and the doctors who come in yelling at them or just disturbing everything. So I designed, with the help of an architect and a nurse, a no hidden patient nursing unit. And it was a dining room table right in the middle of the unit. And it had patient rooms right around it, and it had windows for every single room. And by the way, they had curtains on the other side in case somebody was changing a dressing and they wanted privacy. But the bottom line was, if you and I are sitting with a table in between us, and I look at you and I say, Corinna, the patient behind you is pulling out his drink tube, that's a whole lot easier than seeing a bell ring and somebody pushing a nurse call button all the time. And you have to get up from our discussion and run down the corridor to take care of whatever patient it was. You might remember which one it was, because by the time you get there, it might be, oh, no, I think it was this patient in this room. Oh, no, it was this patient in the other room. I started a whole movement called the No Hidden Patient Movement. And it was just so nursing care focused, because the nurses at the end of the day were wiped out.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I've been in hospitals that are arranged more like that, with a kind of spokes off the wheel principle, because it's like, then in that way, they can also get to patients much more quickly from the so-called kind of command center at the center, so that there's better outcomes too, especially in critical care units. So I think that all makes sense. It's logical, right? So you've spoken for a moment about this human evolution perspective, how we've gone through our first evolution, and we're essentially in this mid-phase of preparing to go through a second evolution. Can you define what you mean by this and where we are in that cycle, what it will take essentially to get to this next phase?
The first human evolution I have defined as the time when we heard and we knew that mutually assured destruction was something that was a global issue. And so that was some time between the mid-50s and the mid-60s, because that was also the time when existentialism was coming from France, when the whole peace movement was starting. We had Martin Luther King. Nixon was going to China and letting us know in America that there's China is not the name of what's underneath your plate. It's actually a country. There's a lot of things that happened in that period of time that really established our relationship, our awareness of the globe, and the fact that we had already conquered nature. And so that's when it ended. We are now in what I call the suspended human evolution. And it's suspended because we're flopping around like fish on a deck, or we're in one of those Indiana Jones movies where we're one of those bridges that goes from one side to the next, and there's a chasm down below, and if we fall, we're going to die. I mean, that's what the suspended human evolution is. It's this period of time where we better get our act together before the bridge collapses or before the fish dies. I'm thinking about some of the things you're doing with Omega and with taking care of the source of fish and realizing that that too is something that ended sometime around the mid-60s, and now we're eating the fish out of the ocean and they're going to be gone if we don't do something about it. What is the second human evolution? The second human evolution has to be planned. It is no longer the time of the first world, the first human evolution. That's over. We have to be God. We have to be humans who can learn from our mistakes, learn from the past, learn from our history, learn from each other, and start talking and discussing what that second human evolution must be in order for us to stave off whatever this sixth extinction is that I hear about. There was a podcaster who was asking me, he wanted to talk about the sixth extinction. And I just said, I'm not there. I'm thinking about the next step for humanity. What is the next step for humanity? Well, my planning tools include an approach to what's called pre-planning. It's not even planning. It's the pre-planning process. So when you ask, where are we now? We are in that approach process. We haven't got the language yet to be able to go into pre-planning. And pre-planning is where we talk and we agree of stuff, agree to disagree. Forget that. We don't have time to agree to disagree. We got to say, how do we deal with the population problem? Oh, it's not a problem. Okay, let's talk about the facts. And then you start talking about the facts. And I think the most important thing we have to do when we're talking with each other is we have to back up to commonality. That means backing up far enough that we can agree there's a migration problem from the heat belt all around the world that is going northward. And it's hitting our southern border here in the United States. It's crossing the Mediterranean and going to the European countries. And, I mean, you can look at Canada. It's even going north in Canada. They had a huge, gigantic fire in the Yukon. Whoever heard of such a thing?
Wow. Well, I mean, you've just said so much. So I want to slow down for a second and unpack some of it. You're really talking, I think, about a culture shift. And what I mean by that is that when you talk about organizing human behavior in such a way that we agree on what the present state is, and we agree on the challenge, and then we agree on the how, I mean, that's a significant shift in the way we think and ultimately the way that we connect with one another. So how do you see us moving the needle in that direction, or do you see it? And then we can get into some of the specifics, like you mentioned, being overpopulated or having a population problem, as well as the migratory issues, which I think are plain, and get into more specifics from there.
I think the most important thing we're doing is talking about it. And I look at this whole podcast revolution. I don't know. I mean, what you're doing is the most important thing that we can be doing right now. And you are not just talking with me right now. You're talking with other people. And I've seen the list of podcasts that you have done with other people. And I'm thinking, this is great because you are spreading the word. And the word is the spiritual word, okay? It's the word that will bring us all together through our shared definitions of what it is that we believe in. Those are things that we need to talk about. I believe in human immortality. Okay, what does that translate in a discussion about the population problem? Well, I don't talk about population control. I talk about population continuity. Population continuity, because that's what we want on a global scale.
But there are people who say that there's plenty of space and food for 10 billion, 12 billion, even 20 billion people on planet Earth. And they're essentially trying to build a case for that. I have felt for some time personally like we are overpopulated if you consider the concentration of people in a given area, which also forces us, I think, to become more insular because it's harder to find tribes of common people when you have so many thrust into an area from different backgrounds, different jobs, different everything, that we find community on social media, but then they might be in Chicago and we're in San Francisco or whatever. So we're not getting the same type of in-person community as easily as we once might have. And in particular, if we don't do something like go away to college and develop those types of relationships, more people are now shifting to trade schools because they're seeing a little bit less hope from the massive college debt that they might accrue. So we have a lot of small culture shifts that are happening within our society that to me don't lean in yet to the possibility of coming together in the way that I think you're purporting. So one of the things I work hard to do with this podcast is to try and, while I do cover a lot of social impact and sustainability stories, which tend to trend more left side of the aisle, right? Like I'm also welcoming to people who have opposing views and who are talking about freedom of speech and that feeling that they're more limited by the democratic movement and what they call a more socialist agenda. So, I mean, how do we get these two opposing sides to truly come together now with the rapidity that we need them to in order to push for change that can result in that futurist possibility of the development of a utopia where we can all thrive?
I think we can only do what we are able to do. Judge Learned Hand said, you can only do what you do best. And that's what you need to do. And when I think about what my role is, but I look at the project that we did in Myanmar was to build a prototype, not just a health center, but a community development and health center. And it was a prototype because the plan is to build 250 more of those clinics in other areas. This is Burma right here. And it is just as wild and primitive environment as just about anywhere in Africa. And so we went there and we started a whole process, but it was working with the people. It was sharing our tools with the people. It was talking about population continuity and getting discussions going in that regard. And it was interesting because all the birth spacing discussions came up, all the teaching girls discussions came up. It's like what we can do is just what we do. And what I do is I help that whole process of community development and healthcare development at that clinic. And it was wonderful. That's all I can do. And we can talk. And when it comes to people who say, oh, when I fly over the country, I look down and I see all these places that don't have people in them. So why don't we have any problems? And I say, look, all you have to do is go to your grocery store and then come back and complain to me about the cost of food and the cost of gas and everything else, because you're being affected by the supply and demand problem that occurs when there's too many people.
Yeah. And this is exactly the problem that we confronted in the United States this last 15, 20 years, where there is a considerable part of the population in those, let's say, flyover territories that has felt left behind. You see more media now covering what life is like in Appalachia. And you have rising drug epidemics in these arenas, which were largely created by pharmaceutical companies and doctors overprescribing medications that were irresponsible in the first place. So we've created most of the problems that exist here through, I think, profit-driven, extractive principles. And I'm connecting these two ideas because you also speak about something that I think is important for us to consider, not just how many children we all have or don't have, but also how we consume, what we consume, the choices we make. So much of our consumption here in the United States in particular is mindless consumption. We eat when we're watching TV, bag of chips that's supposed to have six servings in it is gone before we stand up again. This impacts our waistline and our health outcomes dramatically. The fact that we go to the grocery store, we're hit with a barrage of snack foods, even more so than the produce and the other more healthy foods that we might consume. And then this idea that we are also kind of pushed with, that somehow our population in the United States will decline unless we start really getting to it and having more babies. Women are tending to have children later, myself included. I had my first child at 38, my second at 41. My husband and I are two and done. He's fixed. It's not happening anymore. I'm still menstruating. I could get pregnant tomorrow, I'm sure, because my family is full of very fertile people. But it wouldn't be the responsible thing for me to do. And this is something that I take seriously. I also note I'm 47 and I want to be around and be an old lady when my kids are at this stage of their life. And that gets harder to do if you have children when you're 45, 50, 60, even if it's possible. So what do you have to say to the Elon Musks who want to have 12 kids and who kind of look down on people if they don't have a lot of children? And what more do you say to those that really just want to consume mindlessly?
Wow. Well, first of all, I have two sons just like you, and I got fixed too. And so I think that's part of our immortality. That's the way we procreate. We replicate ourselves. Each of us replicate ourselves. And that's our donation to the immortality pool. That's where I think a lot of people at. Now, when it comes to Elon Musk and people who want to have a ton of kids, I mean, I've worked in Nigeria and I've looked at the number of children that some of the women have. Mali, for instance, has the highest number of births per woman of anywhere else in the world. And it's something like 11 is average. And I say, well, if that's average, does that mean someone has 20 and somebody else has only 10? You know, it's just weird.
But at the same time, I don't want to villainize people for having more children. I'll give you a for instance. My older sister has 6 children. That's a lot of kids. She started when she was in her 20s, though. And I have to tell you, having had my first child at 38, I feared that I wouldn't connect. I would be one of those mothers that just didn't really love their kid. I've met women that didn't ever really connect with their child. And I had this fear in the back of my mind that it would be like that for me. He came into this world and I was like, oh my God, I get it. I get why my sister had 6 of these beautiful babies. Like, I'm instantly in love in a way that I never experienced before that moment. And I can't knock somebody for having that experience and for wanting to have a big family, in particular when they come from a large family and it feels like it's tradition and love and community all in one.
Well, it's Social Security in Mali. If you have 11 kids, maybe 8 will live, and those 8 will get old enough that when you're in your old age, they'll take care of you. And so we don't have that problem.
But is it really a wealth problem? Do you think that's the impetus, or it's somehow kind of inbred into us from a survival perspective?
The latter. I think you're right. Yeah. I think it's a survival thing, and I highly respect it. We know a woman who has had 10 children, and our first inclination, because we met her when she had 8 and she was pregnant, and I'm going, oh my God, how can we even talk with this woman? It's immoral. And then, you know, the more we thought about it, we realized that, wait a minute, you can't put a morality stamp on it. We've got to figure out how to deal with it. And I think that China started with that one child thing, and that didn't work because it gradually became obvious that one child of two people wouldn't be able to take care of two people when the kid got older and the older people got older.
Well, I mean, and people were preferentially wanting to have boys. And so they would do things like have an ultrasound and, oh, it's a girl. Well, maybe we'll abort this one. Or you read Pearl S. Buck's work and what was it? Imperial Woman and another one, the Pearl, something to that effect, and baby murders. And because they didn't have the preferred son and they wanted the name to live on. I mean, that's the dark underbelly of that regimen. And we need something that is inclusive. I also understand the simple statistic. If everyone in the world lived the way Americans do, we'd need 5.1 Earths to thrive with our current population. We don't have 5.1 Earths. Going to Mars won't solve this for us. So if that's the case, then we need to think about consumption. And we need to think about how we're consuming, what we're consuming, and why. I don't think we're in the habit of asking ourselves why. It just is. So, I mean, your work has me thinking about all of this. And I have to say that I'm an optimist, but I'm also a realist. And I'm struggling with this entire concept of buy-in and getting broad enough buy-in that we can we can remain hopeful and optimistic.
But you are leading the discussion. I don't look at Trump or Biden or any of our politicians to be leading this discussion.
They're in damage control. That's what I think their job is at this point. It's like they aren't actually able to lead because they have too many fires to put out all the time. And so we have to think this through, like that futurist world, the world that we want to build. What does it look like? What is the world you want to build? What do you think it could be? Perhaps this is the note we need to land on.
Well, yeah. And I think this is the reason why I'm trying to put a name on where we've been as humanity, the first human evolution, where we are now, the suspended, and this second human evolution. Come on, let's start talking about the second human evolution. We're in charge. We are in charge of nature. Therefore, what are we going to do and how are we going to get there? Because these issues like the population control problem, supply and demand, and what you're doing in looking at the whole fish industry and that is falling apart, dying, disappearing. I mean, what are we going to do with that? I don't have all the answers, but I do have the tools. And that's where the whole approach, pre-planning process is so important. Now, in my book, I talk about pre-planning a lot, and I give some very, very simple tools in how to discuss these things. Because if we're going to discuss it, how do we discuss abortion? Well, we have to assign for every issue some from and to. So there's a whole process of from to. Well, what is the from to? Well, the from is having all the babies, or the to is having an abortion. Well, no, wait a minute, that's not it. And you get the discussion going so that the people who are absolutely against abortion and absolutely for abortion are really backing up. Because when I am talking with people who are saying, okay, we're going to build a brand new hospital right over there, and we're going to make it really big, it's really tall, and I'm saying, well, where's the information? Where are the statistics? What are you going to do in that hospital? It's like they don't start with this whole process of pre-planning, which is, what the heck do we need? Do we really need a hospital? We have a hospital over there and a hospital over there. Why do we need another one? Oh, well, our corporation has decided that if we don't build a hospital right there, then the other two hospitals are going to take our patients away from them. I mean, the bottom line is we have to start using the tools. From two is a very important tool in the backup process. Okay, what are we talking about?
Are we going from, where are we going to? What's the objective? I mean, it sounds so simple, but you have to define that. And this reminds me of my earlier interview with Paul Hawken, where we were talking about regeneration. And he basically just said, he was amidst this climate argument with all these climate scientists and saying, we have to define the problem. What's the problem? We need to reverse global warming. That's the problem that we need to define. And nobody was saying it. So sometimes I think it's just giving voice to that issue that you aren't defining the problem. So you can't define a solution. I think it's so important that we get there. I really am curious, because you do provide templates within the book. I think it would be helpful for people to understand a little bit of what they could expect from that. If they're working on a particular solution that they want to champion, how would your work help them get there?
The templates are very simple templates. Just like me, I'm a simple guy. I'm not the big academic person here. I'm doing things that will help the people that I work with in the villages, and I don't care if they ever never even went to school. I'm trying to help, and that's what the templates are. I've got a personal template that says, okay, my personal value is I want to care for peace. The way I want to do it is I want to help people in the world, and my attitude is do everything I can to care for peace. And what's the result for me? Well, it's peace for me. It's that feeling. In a relational level, this is the template. You know, on relational level, I want to help other people in their process of caring for people. And what's the environmental? And there's an environmental section on, it's a single page just for the personal template. The environmental is, I better do good to the earth. I need to be a good steward. And these are my core beliefs and feelings and thoughts about what we need to do individually to come to the table and talk with other people about this. Because if they also agree, yeah, I want to care for peace. I want to care for your peace. Yeah, I want to take care of the peace that we have brought to this moment. Let's agree with that. So that's what the templates are. The templates are tools to discuss what it is that we have to discuss, the difficult issues of the day. And how are we going to start? How are we going to get there? That's where at the very bottom, the most important quote I have, I always tell people, they don't have to read the book. They just need the front cover. And the front cover says, the process is the solution. And actually, that's just part of the sentence, because really the process is the solution. The problem is that we don't really have the tools to be able to know where the heck we're going. Well, it's not just two roads diverged in a yellow wood. It's thousands of roads that we need to be thinking about. And how are we going to go down those roads? Well, there's a process. When we stand there, what are we going to do? We're going to talk to the people who are coming down those roads toward us and find out what they know. Before we even take our first step, pre-planning is so important, and it requires us to sit and stand and talk. That's it. That's what you're doing. You and I have been talking this whole time. I'm sitting. You're sitting. This is what we do in the first stages of pre-planning. And thank you so much for leading this process, because I think I am just invigorated by all the podcasts out there. It's people like you who are really, I mean, yeah, there's tons of podcasts like how you can wash your clothes. There's all sorts of, you know.
There are some that are essentially fun conversations between five guys in a bar. You know, there's all sorts of podcasts out there, but there are a fair number that are seeking to build a better world and invite people to think more about the ideas they're confronting. That is what I would beg people to do from this conversation today, is just to think a little bit more. I am coming away with a theme, and one of those themes is that process is important, having a system, but really understanding that going to that like common higher end of thinking, like really thinking more about the solutions and the common ground that we may actually be on already, the path that we can share, that we will get through conflict together, that we will be able to deepen solutions thinking, that we will be able to put forth greater efforts that are more inclusive and that don't just seek to divide. I think that's what I'm getting from this overall conversation.
Amen.
Amen. Well, if there's a closing thought that you'd like to leave our audience with, I'd welcome it. But I also would just like to ask you, what's next for Jeffrey?
Well, I have one closing thought, and it's the first sentence in the preface of my book. And it is this: to care for peace may not be the secret of life, but it is as close to the secret of living there is.
Well, I like that. And I have to say, from the podcast I've heard you on and also through this conversation, I think my synonym for peace is love. So I care about love. And I feel like there are certain inalienable truths, and that is that we all want love in our lives. So if we can care for peace and care for love, I think we can make a better world that we all want to thrive within. And perhaps that can help resolve some of the inner conflicts that we may have as well. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jeffrey. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Pod away.
Pod away.
I know there's a million podcasts out there, but you are one of a very small group of people who are doing what you're doing. I know that because I've been trying to reach out to them.
Yeah. Perhaps you can help me connect with more of them too, because I always want to meet other podcasters who are out there to make a world a better place, and sometimes have cross-guested or even shared their podcast on my podcast stream to bring more people to their show and vice versa. So there's some back scratching that goes on in this community of do-gooders. And I think it's important that we focus on that because, hey, I know that we're living in an attention economy of sorts, but we're all in this together. It's a crazy race for space.
I will send you my list. It's 427 pages long. I'm going to send it to you because it's got every podcast I have connected with. Yours is one of them. I'll send it to you and you can just tick them off.
Yeah, perhaps I'll guest on their show, connect with them. And if they're local to me, even arrange a little pod meetup in person. That would be kind of incredible.
Sounds good. Let's just meet on the pier in Santa Cruz. That restaurant out there is just perfect for me.
Anytime you're here, just reach out. Thank you so much for joining me, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
To find out more about Jeffrey Charles Hardy and his important work, including his book, To Care for Peace, A Global Mandate to Secure the Second Human Evolution in Perpetuity, visit the links in my show notes and in the expanded blog on caremorebebetter.com. I'm also including them in my Amazon shop, which will be linked with show notes at amazon.com/shop/Karina Belizzi. Now, you can find these resources, links, and so much more on my website. So visit the site and join us on this journey to build a better future. When you sign up for my newsletter, you'll even receive a 5-step guide to help unleash your inner activist. If you have a particular cause that you're working to champion, this can provide you with some groundwork. It also includes links to several climate charities that I encourage you to support. Thank you, listeners and watchers, now and always, for being a part of this pod and this community, because together we really can do so much more. We can care more. We can be better. We can even secure the second human evolution of humanity and create that better futurist world that we want to live within. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for social good. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And share with your friends to help us reach more people and spread more social good.